Hello, everyone. Welcome to the last session of the last day. I'm honored to see so many people in here. 2 years ago, I had the last session of the last day in Berlin. I had three very interested people on the front row. This is great. So we're going to talk about IPv6. I decided when I wrote the title to call it Hardcore Networking Services. What I'll cover is the continuation of the Wednesday session, I think it was, and diving a bit deeper onto those topics. How many of you watched the foundational or intro session to IPv6? Okay, so barely half of you. So I'll actually go through some of the stuff that he was talking about as well, just so we have a common foundation to stand on. My name is Daniel, I'm from Sweden. I normally build IPv6 networks. I'm used to working with PowerShell, stuff like that. IPv6 is one of those things that I've been talking about at least for 8 years. It's one of those things that ends a conversation very quickly because, well, no one wants to talk about it. We don't need it. That's the basic response. So I'll actually show why you do need it to a certain extent. IP isn't something that is new. Since the 80s, we've been doing this. IPv6 is actually born in the mid-1990s. So it really isn't something new. 1995, the first RFC was published. Today, the RFC is 2640 that describes the IPv6 protocol. So we have some history. It is still an evolving creature. That's why I think it's so fun to work with IPv6, because it is evolving. Probably you heard stories about things that doesn't work in older versions of whatever stack you're using. Well, it could be true, and it doesn't have to be true at the same time, since we are shifting some stuff around. Okay, why did we go down the route of actually inventing another version of IP? Very simple. We got a couple of core things here. One is complicated headers. As a packet is going through your network, at every single hop, we need to do some calculations because we got a checksum there. So we have to calculate, is this the full packet? Is it correct? Is it intact? Have it been changed? Should I drop it? Should I not? So every little hop on the way, have to check that. That's something that makes the protocol itself a bit slow, if you want, or exactly the machines that are handling that a bit slow. Limited address space. I'm going to talk a lot about the number of addresses. While it may seem infinite, the number of addresses in IPv4, and I know already some of you are thinking like, well, there is address space still left. We can redistribute that space and a lot of those parameters. Yes, we can, but not indefinitely. We have to start already now to... I'll address that a bit more later on. Natively, we don't have quality of services, encryption, integrity of the things that are sent over the wire. Actually, these things have been backported to IPv4 to give us that functionality today. And then, from my perspective, the last point on the slide and the biggest problem in the world, as I see it, it's the existence of NAT. NAT is translation of addresses, private IP addresses. I'm hiding my network behind stuff. This is by many perceived as a security measure as well. I've seen the term NAT firewall. Have you seen that? NAT firewall, it isn't a firewall. It's not even hiding what's behind. It's so easy to find out what's going on behind that device. So at the same time, it's introducing so many problems with real-time application, poor translation. Classical example, if FTP, old protocol that actually encapsulates the endpoint addresses in the data packages. So when you go through a NAT device, you will actually translate not only the header part of the packet, but the actual packet. It takes resources. So these are some of the big points in why we're evolving into IPv6. I have a personal philosophy of not mending anything that is not broken. And that still applies. So if you have a system today, well, if you want to make it indefinitely better for the future and all that, well, of course you can patch it up, but you don't have to make it IPv6 enabled. So, IPv4 exhaustion, where are we now? We have 32 bits of address space. That gives us some 4 billion addresses, I think that is. 256/8 blocks. The pools, as you can see, are near depletion, some of them. The purple ones are the advertised space. Okay, they're both purple, right? Or red or something. My wife calls me colorblind, so the middle color, let us call it that. That's the unadvertised, and then the yellow is the available pool. So there is still space. I'm not going to hide that fact. But due to how we actually divide blocks, how we give out blocks, and the possibilities to get addresses back gives us, well, we're out of addresses. In Sweden, you can read in the newspapers quite often, internet will close down. There is no more internet. It will all die. Well, of course, that isn't true, because we can do multi-stacking. We could have multiple stacks. The current situation is like this. IANA, which is the top level, they are out of address space. There is no more blocks to divide amongst the regional internet registries. APNIC has gone into what they call the last/8 policy, which means that they are really giving out very, very few addresses. So in that region, they are actually suffering today from not being able to get the IP addresses they need. So if you're into that part of the world doing business there, you will see a very immediate increase in the necessity of IPv6. RIPE, we are almost there in Europe as well, opening up the last/8, and that also here triggers that last/8 policy, which will, well, give us very few addresses. The 5th of November 2014 is the day when all IPv4 is, well, we're out. If we don't make another example of, well, let's reassign some reserve space, let's reuse something, let's remove a private IP block. There's a lot of theories about how you could handle that. But since you're all here, you don't want to hear about IPv4. You want to make the right thing, which is another way. And that's IPv6. Just remind you of the two routes that we can go to relieve ourselves from IPv4 extortion. It's the allocation policies, actually giving out less addresses per company, or using NAT. Both of them aren't good. The answer, of course, is then the IPv6 address. We got 128 bits of address space. If you heard the term quad A, we're going to discuss DNS later. Quad A, that's 4 times A. An A record is a 32-bit pointer, so 128 bits, right? I don't know if anyone wants to give it a try to say that number. You've come up here and, yeah? Gazillion? Yeah. It's a really, really big number, right? 2^64 nodes per subnet. We have split the addresses into two parts, actually, the interface ID and the network ID, 64 bits each. I'm going to into deeper details about that later. Just a couple of days ago, or weeks ago now, we had the World IPv6 Launch Day. Some of the major players made their services available on IPv6. I would say that day was in most parts a very successful day. It was a milestone. Many people say that 2012 is the year for IPv6. To some extent, I would agree. But we are still looking at least in my personal view, we're looking at 5-10 years, if not more, of dual stacking using both. Just to give you a bit more perspective on that number of addresses, I would challenge you to use that number of addresses per square inch. So I know there's a lot of famous people in the history of computing that have said, like, this will be forever, this will never end, this is all the memory we'll ever need, stuff like that. Okay, they were proven wrong. And I'm sure I will be that as well someday, but it should be enough. It really, really should be enough. So every device can be accessed by a public address. So that removes all the problems we would have from NATing. We don't need NATing anymore. We need real security instead. Actually securing those IPs, making sure that they are not open from the public, not just hidden from the public view. Oh, sorry. These are the 128 bits we got to play with. We're starting from the reverse end of everything. And if you look at the /48, which is what you are assigned as a customer, the first 16 bits would be your subnet, and the last 64 bits would be your interface ID, your host IDs. We'll talk about how those IDs are generated, the different methods of assigning addresses and keeping track of the address space we got. On top of that, we add 45 bits of routing prefix. That's the regional to local internet registry prefixes, as well as the IANA to regional prefix. And the start is a reserved space for now. So just making sure that we can grow. So will this be enough? Well, we're requesting new blocks every 18th month, historically. And if we're continuing in that pace, we'll run out of addresses 2158. At that point, we'll have 1/8 of all address space assigned. So I would definitely be safe enough to say that while I'm alive, this will be enough. So history may prove me wrong. Some terminology, so that we all speak the same language when we talk about the different types of hosts, machines, network equipment that we have. One, node. A node is something that is in any way, form, or shape handling IPv6 traffic. It could be an endpoint, it could be a router. So a node, that's just something in the way of handling IPv6. A router, that is, of course, something doing routing. A router could be a host. So a host, that is something that doesn't route packages. We could take your fabulous Windows machine as an example. Well, it's a host, right? It doesn't route packages. Then you plug in your 3G modem, and you check that magic box, share this connection. What happens to your machine then? Is that it will become a router for your network. So it's a router. There are specific cases when this can be a problem in the IPv6 world. Since all routers, we have a new way of discovering and finding routers. They're actually finding each other, or the hosts are finding all the routers, even the Windows machines that are acting like a local router. So I have had incidents where single machines have been the way out of a corporate network. So that user felt it on the CPU, I can tell you. But yeah. A link, that is something that connects, like a LAN or WAN connection. It is a single point. It is not routed. So between routers, you will find links. Between computers, you will find links. A neighbor, that is someone that lives in the same neighborhood as myself. That means that I am not passing a router. So that's a neighbor. I'll go into exactly why we're calling it neighbor, and there are some protocols to discover our neighbors as well, neighbor discovery. Talk about that a bit later. And then we have the term packet, which of course means the header plus data. The big changes they did when we're going from IPv4 to IPv6 is simplified headers. We're having a fixed size header. And the big advantage of having a fixed size header is that all the equipment along the way knows what part it needs to check. It knows that those 40 magic bits at the start, that's the header part. That's what I need to look at. In IPv4, you would have to check and then check if there were some more headers and more headers, and well, it took processing powers off those routers and switches along the way. Scalability, of course, you get a lot more hosts. Moving on to QoS, quality of service, we got that built in. I'm going to discuss a couple of different theories on how to do QoS in IPv6. There are some RFCs out there. There are actually multiple RFCs out there describing different approaches to this. We have encryption, ESP, built in. We got authentication, AH, built in. And we got that magic last bullet is the self-configuring part. For you guys who was at the session Wednesday, I'm sure you heard that a DHCP server is a necessity or it should be in the network. Well, this could be debated. I'm one of those guys who would say that up to a certain point, it's not needed at all. After that, yeah, you will need a DHCP server. So I'll go more into that. But hosts can actually configure themselves without using DHCP on what IP they should use, what gateway they should use, finding their way out to the internet basically by themselves without us configuring a single thing. A couple of years ago, a customer called me and he said, Daniel, I got a problem. My log, it shows there's something really, really wrong with my machine. It's trying to connect to a MAC address. So I was a bit confused and had to have him send the log file over, and I saw an IPv6 address. It's actually nothing new about IPv6 in Windows. We prefer that since many years. So we'll actually take that route if it's available in the machine. And it does have some similarities to a MAC address, absolutely. It's 16 bits and then a colon, and we follow that pattern up to 128. This is a typical address. It's an FE80 address. I'll explain that prefix in just a little while. We do have some segments with zeros. We also have here 0290, which starts with an O. So we can do some simplification here. The first thing we'll do is zero group compression. You see that we have a group of zeros at the start of the address. We'll just strike those zeros out. We'll just remove them and replace them by a double colon. We can do that once in an address. If we did it twice, well, the host couldn't say how many zeros in each place. So that's why we can do it once. We can also do something called leading zero trimming. That's removing the zeros in the addresses so they get even more compact. And we get down to this point. So this is actually the same address, just written a bit more compact. Does it still seem scary? Yeah, a bit long. You heard about this fantastic new thing we got, DNS, it's called. Yeah? I'm going to talk about DNS. It's a fabulous tool for actually finding hosts, so you don't have to remember IP addresses. I don't know why network administrators are so afraid of and use it as an argument. I hear it all the time. Well, I can't use IPv6. I wouldn't remember all the IP addresses. And my counter to that is always, do you remember it today? Yeah, well, they remember two or three hosts, the ones they actually use. And then the rest, they use the host name anyway, so. But okay, you can simplify the addresses to a certain extent. Let's start with some good prefixes to know. This is about 15% of the total space. And if you have heard about FEC0, that is now depreciated. It isn't in use anymore. You will find it in certain places. I'll talk about that in just a few seconds. The important things on this slide is actually the global unit cost, the 2000:/3, which is basically the public internet. We have the link local, FE80:7. That is the point-to-point between hosts on the same link as myself. That is something you will always see. It is used frequently in communication between me and my router, and to some extent you can also use it between hosts in a network. We got the multicast space, FF:, which is very important. So you cannot get by in IPv6 without multicast. And then we have a last little point at the end there that's called ULA or unique local, that is FC0. Don't. This is like reintroducing the 192.168 address space again. Don't do it. You just got rid of NAT. Why would you introduce it again? It could be used in labs, in testing, in situations where you do not need to route it. It shouldn't be routed. So about FEC0. In some rare occasions, you will see this. Once we had a fabulous idea of something called site local, that was common services in a bigger site or local to the enterprise, partly like the FE80s. I kind of like the idea that every DNS server in the whole wide world would be FE000, FFFF1, 2, and 3. That would have been so simple, because then even I could remember them, regardless of where I was. So if nothing else is said to a Windows machine at this time, it will fall back to these three addresses. And there is nothing in the whole wide world that doesn't say that you can't put these addresses on a DNS server. It's not recommended, it's not best practice, but you can do that. You can even have it in your firewall or router, so they rewrite and send the request to these machines. So you won't have to configure a DNS server, basically. This is a last resort. It is not supported. It is not in use. It's deprecated. So, but if you see it, you know why. Okay, so I gave you a bit more difficult addresses. Now I'm going to give you some more simple addresses that have actually been simplified. 127.0.0.1 is now ::1. That's reducing the length of address, isn't it? Quite much. Easy to remember. I'm sure you all have seen this when you did some ping localhost thing, and at first you got like, "Huh? What's happening?" Well, it's just a local machine. :, that is the unspecified everything, 0.0.0, formerly in IPv4. Are these ones you should know by heart. Okay, so when our machines come up, when we connect to a network that isn't IPv6 enabled, we haven't done any configuration on our Windows box at all, we still get this FE80 address. If you remember the 169.254 addresses that were given to machines that couldn't reach a DHCP server, there was an idea of these machines actually being able to communicate with the routers and stuff, and the routers should actually listen to 169.254. But we didn't get there with this, but we got here with FE80. So FE80 is where a machine actually goes up. It takes an address itself. This is derived from either the MAC address, the EUI64, or just as in Windows, it's randomized. So we're getting an address, bring that interface up. Because we need an address. We need an initial address to be able to communicate with our routers. Because our routers will tell us where to find stuff. We could have one or multiple routers. It doesn't really matter. The concept of configuring a default gateway, sure, you can do that. but you will actually get routing information from the network itself automatically. And to be able to send DHCP messages, you will also need an address. So that's the purpose of the link local address, to get that first initial address. You'll actually get two of them. I'll not go into the details of that, but you'll get a temporary and a permanent one. And when you get in contact with your router, I'll go into that details about that process in just a few moments, you actually get a global unicast address. And that is what you're using to communicate out on the worldwide web. Why did I get there? It's like in the 2000s you said like that. But yeah, okay. As I said, we do have the ULAs as well, unique local addresses. Well, if you want to use them, I could give you a thousand reasons not to. NATing is one of them. Why would you use an address that could be in use somewhere else when we got an infinite number of addresses for your organization? Use public addresses. You have firewalls to block out what you don't need to get inside. Don't hide it behind address translation or anything like. Use these in your labs. That's where they belong, to test stuff in the lab so it doesn't get out on the normal network. So, this is one of the simplest slides to write, I think. Windows and IPv6. IPv6 is preferred. Windows will, if it can, use IPv6. And this has been a truth since Windows Vista. So it's nothing new. It's actually one of the most common ways I use to when we're doing penetration testing, when we're going into people's networks and checking if they're secure. I'll just take an IPv6 enabled computer, I put it in the network, and I'm in. Because no one checks for that kind of traffic in the network. They got IPS systems, but they are listening only to IPv4 traffic. There are a lot of tunneling protocols here as well. I have I've seen a trend, at least in some parts of the Scandinavians, where users are getting more and more local admin rights. They can actually install programs themselves from the internet. And that's a separate debate. We can take that offline or something. But when they do that, they can also enable some protocols when they're local administrators. Like they can enable a protocol called Teredo, which basically opens your network up. You get a bridge into your network by IPv6. I'm not going into detail about that, but you have a lot of bridging protocols. You've got three of them built in straight out of the box. And if you don't configure something, they can be used to leverage attack against a company. And by the way, you can't turn IPv6 off fully, even with registry entries. So there's no way of actually disabling all of it. Most of it? Yeah, sure. And you can firewall some of the worst security implications as well. So IPv6 is preferred. I'm going to show you this in a demo in just a couple of seconds. It will always take that route, even between hosts up to networks. I've seen cases where the IPv6 address is registered in the DNS, so when the client tries to log on, it can't communicate, but the address, it's IPv6, and it's registered in the DNS, so the client will try to log on to that domain controller with IPv6 address and will fail. And the result will be a very slow network because you have to wait for the timeouts. There have been some improvement to this, specifically Windows 8, which will actually have a state of the connection because we've seen that it's such a big problem with all the broken IPv6 networks that are half completed or half set up or something like that, and it doesn't work. So the Windows 8 machine will actually know the state of the network by trying to actively go out and access resources by IPv6, and if that fails, it will fall back to IPv4 instead without waiting for that timeout. I delivered this session in Orlando about 2 weeks ago. One of the comments I got was, have more demos. An IP? I don't know. Demos? Yeah. So I'm going to do a demo now. Hold on to your seats. I'm going to ping something. So I'm using the same tool as I did before when pinging stuff. Ping. If you want to, you can explicitly say that it should use version 4. Or, of course, version 6. Should I repeat the demo? Or? But what you could see, when I actually did the ping, www.bing.com, it actually went over to IPv6. It preferred that address. So let's check a NSLOOKUP. And we're doing the NSLOOKUP. I'm talking to IPv6 DNS server at this specific moment, but I don't have to. If you have an IPv4, you can put IPv6 questions over that link as well. And you can see the response. I get 2 IPv6 addresses and I get 2 IPv4 addresses, but still Windows prefers the IPv6 address. And this is one of the reasons why you need to know IPv6, or at least you need to know enough to keep bad stuff from happening, right? Because it's enabled, it prefers that way, so users can actually go around many of the blocks you have in your network by simply going the IPv6 way, and it's not even something they do with, they're not planning on doing it, it's just something that gets done for them. So the tools are the same. That's the basic line here. Ping, NSLOOKUP, all those tools are exactly the same. We're native in IPv6. Okay. Let's dive a bit deeper into the actual package itself. These are the 40 magic bytes that are the IPv6 header. The first thing we got is the version field. And I would presume most of you would guess that it says 6. Yeah, it does. So, IP version 6. Then comes the traffic and flow labels. These are two fields I'll talk about in just a few moments in another slide. They are very important, or could be very important in the future, depending on how we're using them. Then comes a length field that actually describes length. There is no checksum here. Note that. Then comes the next header field, which is the important field here. If this field is set to a header value, we know that following this header will be another type of header, which is also a fixed length header. These are not necessarily processed by all nodes on the way. They could be. It's one of those where the RFC states should and should not, and depending on the level of that network equipment as well, on which level it operates, it will or will not check. But otherwise, the machine actually got what it needs just by reading the two next fields, with this, the source address and the destination address. Big thing, fixed length. We can extend the headers. It's built to be extendable. It is not protected by a checksum, which makes it easier to make changes. That doesn't mean that we can make changes to the data part of the package, right? It's still protected. We got integrity headers. We could have authentication headers. That actually protects the information itself, but we can change how the package is flowing from one node to another. Extension headers is where we point to the next header. So in our little header, IPv6 header, we could point to a hop-by-hop header. That header, in turn, could point in itself to a destination option, which could be a routing header, which could point to a fragment header, and so on. So these headers, they stack on top of each other. They point to each other. It makes it very much easier to actually read, because we know how long those headers are. If we know that the next header that is coming is a fragment header or a routing header, then we know how many bytes we should skip ahead. If we find something that we don't recognize, we void the package. There is a recommended ordering for these packages, headers, just to make sure that we get them in the order and we don't need to traverse or parse more headers than we actually need. And it all ends with header 59. No more headers. End of line. It's all done. Traffic class and flow labels. The traffic class is very much similar to the RFC for IPv4, where we describe a type of service field. It's a field actually just describing the package. If you're looking at different RFCs, there have been some comments how to use that, but it's basically type of service, so you know how to address that package on routers, on switches along the way. The really interesting label is the flow label. This is for real-time applications. It is something that should not but could be touched along the way from one node to another. It is a thing where you could actually have an application write a value, and that specific flow would be handled along the way in a specific way. So we know that belongs together with some other information. When I was in Atlanta, I was talking about RFC 3697. It's been obsoleted by 6437, which describes how routers along the way also can use these fields for ranging from security to other stuff. So it's an exciting read. I'm not sure that we're at the end of the road how these fields are supposed to be used, but we have some expansion possibilities of using these fields. Moving on to control protocols. In IPv4, we have a range of them, from ICMP to ARP and etc. In IPv6, we got one, ICMP. Everything basically in IPv6, from the package size, the maximum MTU unit, is set by ICMP messages. Just because we're allowing some types of ICMP messages doesn't mean that we need to allow them all. I know that some people are having discussions about, oh, then you could ping up all my network and you can find all the hosts and stuff like that. Yeah, but that's another type of ICMP message. Also, I would challenge anyone to ping, well, the 33 million addresses I've got in my subnet. So, I mean, it's not that easy to map out anymore. We got very vastly much bigger address space. So, ICMP messages, they are basically the same as an IPv4. We got a type field. Number 0 to 127 is errors, and 128 and above are informational. The body of the package up until the maximum length of a single package is the start of that package that is the result of the operation or result. So if you send a package that is too big, you actually get the start of that package you sent back, so you can see that. It must not be fragmented. There is no fragmentation. There is only source fragmentation in IPv6. And you cannot send an ICMP message in reply to an ICMP message. There is no more broadcast. Yes? This one? Yeah, if I send a, let's say I get an error message, an ICMP error message that says my message exceeds the size, then my router equipment cannot respond with another message back also stating an error. So that's just to prevent that we get ICMP overflow or looping or whatever. So the question was just to make that a bit clearer on the last one there. So broadcast is dead, long live multicast. There is no more broadcast, and I think most people are quite happy for that. Broadcast is something that easily can kill a data center. when it comes to capacity. Instead, we have multicast. So because we need it for our protocol itself, we cannot have nodes that does not support multicast. IGMP snooping is a good thing to enable on your equipment as well. It is actually looking at the groups and dynamically configuring the ports. So the multicast groups are on the right ports of the switch and so on. A bit simplified, but yeah. Multicast addresses. Oh, nice one. How many saw the animation error? Yeah, the ordering. Okay, anyway, that was just to keep you on your toes. The multicast addresses are like any other address. It's in a well-defined scope. They are of two types. If we look at the flag field, it's a well-known or a transient. A well-known is, for instance, all routers. That is a specific scope. That is a specific multicast address. So that's a well-known. But if we're setting something up for a specific transmission of a lot of data, then it's a transient one. Scope, which is the scope of this address, node local, link local, or global internet. So just defining where should this address belong. And group ID is all nodes, all routers, and there are a couple of others as well, describing which machines belong in this. The ones you need to know by heart are actually these ones. Node local, FF01:1, and link local, FF02:1. That is equivalent, I would say, to broadcast. What I'm trying to show in this session is actually that everything you know from IPv4, it still exists, but in another form or shape, or so you shouldn't be that afraid of going over to IPv6. So link local FF02:1 is equivalent of the multicast, the broadcast. So it goes to all the machines on my local link. That is every machine that is connected to the same link as myself. Then we have some more specific ones for routers. For example, we have a node local one and a link local one. So all routers of my network that I'm on, the link that I'm on, can be reached by FF02:2. So by sending a message there, I can communicate with all routers. I don't actually need to know where the router is because they have joined this multicast group. So I can reach them by that address. We got something called solicited node multicast groups. I want to mention this, just a quick mention, is that when all hosts joins a solicited node multicast group, it is addresses that are similar. So it takes the last 24 bits of a node address, puts that into a multicast group and joins that. It can be used to communicate and check if the address is still in use and things like that. So, jumping ahead to neighbor discovery. Since we're on the network, we need to know how our neighbors, who are they? Our neighbors, that was all the nodes that was on the same link as myself. This is ICMP version 6 messages, multicasted. So what it happens is that my machine, it sends an NS message, a neighbor solicitation message. And all the neighbors, they respond by saying, hey, I'm here. They do that with an NA, neighbor advertisement message. There are two types of those messages, S1s and flag number 2, which is unsolicited. Unsolicited is me just broadcasting, I'm here, regardless if you're actually asking for me or not. So this is to discover hosts. The information I get back is stored in the NC and the DC, which is the neighbor cache and the destination cache. So that's a list of nodes that I can reach. So I keep that list for myself. That list is also have some metrics stored along with it. For example, the MTU of that, and so on. That information I can share with other nodes. So if you send out a solicitation message, I can actually respond by saying, hey, I'm on the same link. I know these three guys as well. One of the guys, I haven't seen him for a while, so he's a bit stale. But the other two, I know they're there. So every machine constantly gets fed information about all the other machines on that same link. And again, a link, it is not 1 million billion machines. A link is what's connected to the same logical network as yourself. It's the same side of the router as yourself. It's just to keep which machines are here. But to be able to communicate and find the actual machines, yeah, we use ARP, right? This is ARP. Neighbor discovery. Because the machines, they say, well, I'm here. I have this address. I have this link layer address. So, again, what we're used to, ARP, has almost an equivalent. We got a modern version of it, basically. Since we're talking to nodes in our vicinity, we don't have to flood the network with broadcast messages, so it reduces network load as well. Quick note about Anycast. How many of you have heard about Anycast before? How many of you have heard about it in IPv4? Good. This is where you have multiple machines actually wearing or having the same IP address. This makes sure that I always get to the closest one. For instance, the internet domain root service, the NES root service, they are Anycast instances. So there are multiple machines behind every IP of that, just to make sure that we cannot... it makes it hard to attack. It makes it easy to maintain because I don't have to think about geographical load balancing and stuff like that. The network itself will solve that because the shortest path is the path I'll go. So by having that, we can have... this is just a normal unicast address. The only difference is that we do not do duplicate address detection on these addresses when we bring them up. Duplicate address detection, DAD, is when we go out and check, do someone else have my address? Well, that would break Anycast, so we don't do that. Otherwise, this is normal unicast addresses. It's an easy and cheap way of increasing availability of services, specifically web servers and things that are not stateful, that does not require you to go to the same machine and do not need to sync between the machines, back-end machines, public-facing websites, for instance. Okay, so we have our IPv6 machine, and I would turn it on. And we need to do is a couple of things. We need to set an interface address, a network address, that is, tell the machine, who is it? There's a couple of different ways to do that. One is manual. You could go out to the machines. You've done this before, right? In the good old days when we didn't have DHCP everywhere, went out to the machines, typed the address, then we went to another machine, and then we changed IP range, and we had to go to all those machines once again. So we discovered some ways of doing that automatically. So we have a couple of different ways of doing it automatically in IPv6, stateful or stateless. I want to talk about that. So when the machine comes up, we need some additional parameters like domain name, DNS servers. What else? What else do we send? Information like that. What we can do is that we can send routing information without configuring anything, with doing the auto thing. If we need anything else like DNS servers, domain names, we need to use DHCP. So when I'm configuring that local address, as I said, there are a couple of different approaches to it. Manual is one. Auto-configuration EUY64 is used by most operating systems except Windows. Windows is using randomization. And this is because EUY64, it's actually traceable. I'll go into that in just a second. And the last method, of course, is DHCP version 6. There are a couple of others. I'm just having them on the slide so you can go out and bing them later on. So the EUE 64, which is used by most operating systems, is where you take your MAC address, then you put FFFE in the middle of the MAC address, and then you do some, you could do some magic stuff with that first octet as well, just changing, flipping that bit around, and you will get what's called a MEUI64. The reasons for us not using this in Windows is because it's traceable, right? You just have one computer with the same MAC address. Well, the idea is that you only have one address, machine with the same MAC address. I'm sure all of us have been in the situation where we have a conflict, but that shouldn't happen. So by randomizing that address, we'll not have a connection to the physical machine, and therefore I cannot trace a specific user. So it's a privacy issue. Just so you know, this method is used by some. So if you see the FFFE in the middle of a IPv6 address, it is a auto-configured EUI64 address. So when we're doing this, we're actually taking that address up. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. It should be, from what I know, yeah. Well, when it comes to the server machines, I would say that manual configuration perhaps isn't a bad thing. I wouldn't like my servers to change IP every 5 minutes or whatever. It shouldn't do that as well, but yeah, it could do. So, or we could use DHCP for them, so bind to them that way. So I'll get back to a little bit about that in just a few seconds. So the machine goes up. It has a randomized address. It goes up, it checks, it do something called DAD. Checks, do someone else have my address? And if not, it actually moves that address into an active state and start communicating with that address. So node X starts, it assigns address Y on interface Z. Okay, read it slow and you'll understand. Interface Z joins the multicast groups. So the interface is still not talking outbound traffic. It just joins in and listens in to the network. And the first thing it checks is on that multicast group, is there any NS queries for me? If there is, it would be an indication of there is another node sending out announcements for it. So the address is taken already. So then X puts itself in an active state, sends out a message to itself. If that message doesn't come back to the machine, that means someone else already got the address, and it will re-randomize the address. Otherwise, it goes back and say, yeah, okay, I'll take that address and go up with that address. So it does have a algorithm for detecting duplicate addresses. And I've done this, as it's called, slack. In networks in excess of 1,000 nodes, I have no problems whatsoever. The big problem is when someone comes in and asks, who had that address at that specific time? Because the machines are randomizing themselves. They're just coming up, they're talking to the routers, they get their public address from the router. Well, I don't know which machine it was. I have no idea. So that's also one reason to have DHCP. Accountability, that you can actually follow up who did actually have that address at that specific time. So my machine is up, it's got its address, so I must find a router. I do that by sending a router solicitation message on FF02:2. I'm asking, is there any routers out here? And they will respond. They will say, yes, I'm a router. I have this prefix. I have these public addresses. So you can take one of them to use as your public IP address, because what I've got so far is the FE80 address, right? So the machine now gets in contact with a router or multiple routers and get a public prefix and randomizes an address on that and goes online with that public IP address. The router advertisement message is also going out periodically to describe if there are any changes. I could have new prefixes, I could have new routes. So I'm sending that out continuously. All machines must all the time process all the error RA messages, or all the router advertisement messages. The router advertisement messages is built like this. You got 8 bits, 8 bits. Oh, you can see the thing there. The interesting part is these options here. It's actually the router that tells a machine that it should go to DHCP. So the router says, hey, you're a managed machine. You should get your address not from me, but from the DHCP server. So when it gets this kind of message, the node goes up and, oh, okay, I'll go to the DHCP server instead. And it talks to the DHCP server and gets its address from there instead of randomizing one. O means options. Via DHCP version 6. So it actually says, okay, you should get your domain name and DNS servers as well from DHCP. So what you could do is you could actually just set the O flag and just distribute that by DHCP. Otherwise, we'll be using the FEC0 DNS servers, which wasn't recommended anymore. Okay, so the router advertisement messages goes out. It contains information about what prefix, how long that prefix is, how long it will be valid, how big the packages are that I can send. Because we have no fragmentation anymore, we have to have a path MTU, as it's called. So I get that as well from my nearest host. And when I communicate with another host, I get that host's MTU value back in my cache as well. MTU, that is the biggest packet. 1280 is the smallest one. We start by that, and then we're increasing until we reach the packet too big. And then I know how big packages I can send. So built into this is also maximizing the package size. And that could be that could vary, of course, by link. So because we don't have fragmentation, other than fragmentation, source fragmentation, well, I have to know the biggest package available on the link. So RA messages, router announcement messages. This is one of the simplest attacks there is. This is something that I've actually also now built into an ActiveX component that could be placed on a web page and executed by a user that is not admin. This is not something that is specific to Windows. It is actually very possible to do this in multiple different operating systems. So on the screen now you'll see a Windows 7 client machine running a very exciting video. Just to show you, it's running quite smooth, about 29% on the CPU, nothing special. I'll just keep that running, and it's on loop, so it should loop pretty well here. On this side, I'll just bring up the... Oh, it didn't help. Anyway, here is Wireshark. I'm sure you all know about Wireshark. This is a recording of the network attack. So what I'm doing in this attack is actually, you can see the description field over here. I'm sending out fake router announcement messages. What was a router advertisement message? Well, it was me describing which routes I had. And all the nodes had to process this all the time. So if we look at the specific message. So I'm actually sending out an MTU option, a prefix. I just randomized something here. And all the hosts that get an RA message, they'll say, oh, a new prefix. I need a public address for that. Calculate a new address and bring that up on the interface. So this little recording I have of an attack, it contains, well, more than one package. And it goes quite quick. And as I said, you can embed this into an ActiveX in the wild, and it will get Macs, it will get the phone we shouldn't talk about, the Linux operating system or whatever, it will all go down. So I'll just double-click my file here. And what this file does, it is takes 10 instances of command, and it replays that attack. Okay, the machine is up to 100% CPU. The video is starting to lag. don't know, what are we, 1 second into the attack or something? Okay, I think it is almost dead. Even if I stop this attack, the machine will not fully recover because it's still got a lot of addresses. Because every one of these router announcement messages brings up another address. So it has to keep up with that. This is a pretty decent machine anyway, so let's just... Okay, I'm stopping the attack. The video will actually start to resume a bit here. Yeah, and then I can click start. Let's just start something simple. It's a bit sluggish. I don't know what we could take. Sorry? The IP config. Let's try and bring that up. It's working hard on this one. This attack is actually also possible to do with Windows 8. I got a few IPv6 addresses, right? Is this easy to block out, do you think? Yeah, very. Because you can set limitations on most switches today if they accept router announcement messages from ports. So, I mean, there is one port that should send them. It's your router. All others shouldn't send them. So if you do that, it's safe. Check in Hyper-V, the new Hyper-V version. You'll have an option for it as well. Okay, do you believe me? There are some addresses here. I'm running a bit behind the schedule where I'm supposed to be at this point, but the attack, as I said, is also doable with Windows 8. No problems there. The difference is that it's built a bit more robust, so it will actually survive the attack. It will go down, it will freeze, but as soon as I'm stopping sending the packages, it will resume and will be workable again. The Windows 7 2008 R2 will be down, basically. Okay. So, a couple of rules. Don't route RAs. You can, if you are not using auto-configuration, you can block RA messages. Just look in the Windows firewall. You will find a rule for incoming router announcement messages. Just disable that. Do it in group policy, and you would be safe again. This is one of the things that no one does because you didn't know about it. You just kept IPv6 there because you haven't configured anything, so how could I attack you, right? So this is denial of service. I've already talked about fragmentation, that we don't do that on the way anymore. It's the source only. Maximum MTU, 1280 bytes. If we are bigger than the maximum MTU, well, we get an ICMP message back. This means that we're constantly sending as big packages as we can. Okay, moving ahead. Something that haven't really changed. DNS. DNS is the same as it was before, basically. You got quad A records. A records. There's no magic behind that. The thing that gets a bit long is the PTR records. I'm not sure what you think about that, but every nibble, every number in the IP address must be typed out, written out. So, well, yeah. Is this hard to do, you think? Now, there's a wizard for it, right? So you enter the IPv6 address and it generates the zone for you. You don't have to think about it. If you're using the Windows built-in DNS server, just go ahead, just enable dynamic updates. You'll have no problems whatsoever with keeping track of this. And you can secure that as well. If you don't want to go the DNS way, you can go into something called LLMNR. This is for local name resolution. This is something that is working very well in very small networks. It's a broadcast-based thing where you actually send out a package UDP 5355 is the port on FF02:1. The responses are then received back with unicast. So I go out and I say, hey, is there any machine here that's called server? And the server responds by unicast to me with his addresses. This is working for single label names. So first we check DNS, then we check DNS for single label names, then we check LLM. Yeah, try to say that really, really quick, really, really late. LLMNR. So it checks that, and if that fails, it falls back to NetBT. If we got IPv4, that doesn't support IPv6. So name resolution, it's quite like it always has been. The big difference is the LLMNR protocol. And you could say that is replacing something as well, right? Got its similarities. So everything that you learn with IPv4, it's still the same, basically. Moving ahead, what I see is that we'll have a dual stack with IPv4 and IPv6. One of the big moves ahead is the possibility to use NAT64. NAT64 has nothing to do with NATing, actually. It's translating between IPv6 and IPv4 addresses. That's built in to server 2012. So you can actually do that. So you can dual stack machines in a far better way, far simpler way today than you could before. So your machines today, they prefer it. It's enabled. It's there. So if you're setting up new stuff, set that up in IPv6. The old stuff, well, keep it as it is. It will break someday, and then you fix it, and then you use IPv6. It is not an all-in methodology. You will need to know IPv6 anyway, today, already, because otherwise you could be a target of an attack I just shown you. So you will need to know it already today. But you don't need to do all your systems now. Tunneling protocols. I know that in the Wednesday session they were talking about tunneling, or should have been talking something about the tunneling and the tunneling protocols, and basically the end of that discussion was, don't use it. And my point is, don't use it. Because you're still dual stacking. You don't need it. The tunneling methods are 64 Teredo and isotap. If you download this slide deck, there will be some notes under each slide which have further references to additional resources and so. So they're there for you. Routing principles, there are no big changes actually. First, of course, if I have the host locally, it will go to that host. Otherwise, it will search for the longest prefix or otherwise default gateway. So no changes there. The routing protocols, well, they're the same. They got new names. RIP-NG. It works exactly as RIP did before. It's got the same problems as it did before. It's just got a NG on the end. So it handles bigger addresses. That's the change, right? BGP, it's called 4+. I don't know why. It's working exactly the same way. You announce a prefix, and someone gets that prefix list from you. Oh yeah, the prefix list, since the addresses are bigger, you need more memory in your routers. Much more memory. I think it's like 4 or 6 times the IPv4 table already. So, yeah. OSPF. Yeah, it's still the same. But there is one small thing to think about there. The router ID itself, they haven't changed the format of that because they come to the conclusion you will not have more than 4 billion routers. So probably should make all right with having the router ID in that format. And it looks like an IP address. But it isn't really. It's just written that way. So to summarize some of the advantages of IPv6, more efficient addressing, end-to-end addressing, no NATing, no fragmentation, no checksums. There's only one protocol about controlling our IP environment that we need to learn, ICMPv6. We could use auto-configuration. The headers are modular. There are loads of good security that is built in. As I said, IPsec, it came from here. So it's working very good here. Just a very quick view to show you that server. Nothing changed. As I said, what I want to show you is basically is that what you already know is applicable still. You can move into this quite open-eyed. This is the DHCP server. We got an IPv4 node. We got an IPv6 node. On the IPv6 node, guess what? We got an IPv6 subnet. And I got scope options. And the scope options, they are the same, more or less. We've got a few more, less here, but as you can see on the numbers, you can actually get quite a bit larger number of options in here. So this is what's set up. We're the DHCP server. It's got reservations. It's got exclusions. You can see the active leases, just as you did in IPv4. So right-click, new scope. A prefix. You'll probably see that prefix quite a lot, 2001:DB8. That's actually a documentation prefix. We have so many addresses that we have a specific range for documentation, just to make sure that that doesn't get routed somewhere. So we just, I'm making this very simple. So. Ta-da! Okay, was there any big differences from IPv4? Nah, same. DNS, we still got the same types of records. Yeah, the reverse zone, it's trickier. Can say that, primary zone, IPv6 reverse zone. I think there are too many dots. You don't get a default file name. Ta-da. Okay, you don't have to type all the zeros. It actually calculates it for you. And then just right-click new host and or enable dynamic updates if you're on an Active Directory machine. Here is example.com. Right-click, new host. And I can type my IPv6 address here. It's the same. I'm 1 second, 1 minute 40 seconds from ending the session, so I urge you to go to the MyTechEd site since the event is basically over. I don't know when they close the labs, but you have a tool there called IPAM, IP Address Management. Since you're getting quite a few addresses now, it could be a good idea to skip the Excel sheet. I don't know, 300 million rows. Yeah. Go into IPAM, check that out. That lab will be available as well from the MyTechEd site when you're at home. Check that out. It's a good way of managing your addresses. So just finally breaking some myth. If the argument is can't remember addresses, well, use DNS. That's what it's for. I actually have two good examples of addresses actually being shorter. We're habit animals, right? We have learned it in a certain way, and we're going to keep doing it in a certain way. So this is just overcoming that. And the biggest myth, I don't need it. Well, let me tell you, you already got it. So regardless of what you think, you need to know it. Someone needs to know it. Someone needs to actually set that option for RA in your switches. So that doesn't spread. Just fix those small things. You don't need to implement it everywhere. You need to know enough to make it secure. As I said, that's the most common attack vector we have today. It's much more simpler than going after the IPv4 systems, which you are very good at securing. So, I mean, why should I try to go into those systems when I can just use the open machines you got? I actually know people that disable the IPv6 networks, firewalls, because they don't have IPv6, they think. Well, yeah, they do. Learning more, go on to tunnelbroker.net. That's a really good resource. It starts off with you getting one IP address, and then a lesson, how to do it. Then you get a point for scoring a test, and then you get a little subnet, so, and you do some stuff with that, and then you get some more scores, and you get a bigger subnet. So it's actually hands-on, after-you-go experience. Perfect thing for the office. The top one is 1,500 points. Who gets there fastest? Perfect competition for the office. GoGo 6, if you want to use tunneling, I use that here today to go out to the internet. You get loads of resources, reference materials, good reading. Microsoft got a site as well on IPv6. They got one on TechNet. The networking teams got one as well. This is for the networking teams, IPv6 site. Go on to that. And, well, basically you can't go to them anyway, so... Let's see. I think the most important thing here is now this one. Don't forget to submit your evaluation, and thank you very much for listening, and have good and safe travel home.